Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. I also want to tell you that if you are going to make your appeals to heaven, then actually the show, my focus for today is kind of going to be on this, our government and its ties or its evolution regarding its relationship with Christ and our Creator, let's just say that. And so if you are going to make an appeal to heaven and you're willing to organize something, just let us know, or you can join Loud and Liberty. They have prayer every day, Monday through Friday. So just check out the link and you can get involved in an appeal to heaven. That debt is fraud again, and again, your campaign begins today. What we need to do is we need to start holding public servants accountable. We need to start the PR campaign now. That's what has to happen, period. Okay, so let me dive into the topic du jour, because it's kind of interesting. My given day goes in so many different directions, and my given day, sometimes those directions have a real good impact on what I think is important. Or actually, let's just say by happen chance or by divine nature, conversations occur which kind of lend to people really. This is one of the major problems that we have in America today. Now, I've gone over the history, and I guess I need to do it again, and I want to do it in maybe a different fashion, but America evolved, and as a matter of fact, when the Constitution was created, it changed the framework of our government, and the legal system was still evolving. And so what I want to do today is kind of capture that, but I need to create the foundation or how we evolved away from the power that controlled us. In other words, Britain. Now, we've talked about Britain and its government. Britain was a part of the Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Empire. And so the Roman Catholic Empire was basically a theocracy. Britain was a theocracy as well. And as a matter of fact, the monarchs of Britain were coronated by whomever was appointed by the Pope to go coronate, you know, that their monarch way up in the nether reaches of the Northern Atlantic. And so I don't think that, I'm not sure if there was ever a king that was actually anointed by the Pope, but there were monarchs in Europe that were. Now, as we look at Britain and its legal foundation, Britain started breaking away from the civil law of Rome in, what, the 11th century, something like that. And they started implementing common law. In other words, the prevailing law that was there to protect the justice of the people based on their religious beliefs. Because, see, civil law didn't have that. Civil law was a bunch of statutes, and there was a kind of a separation between the legal system and the the governing system, because the governing system was a theocracy. And so the kings had general powers, and they were supposed to be constrained by the Bible. And, you know, they were supposed to be noble, good servants. Well, that didn't happen all the time. As a matter of fact, you know, in Britain's history, there was this, you know, term Bloody Mary, or the bloody, you know, reign of Queen Mary. So they had their share of tyrants. Now, as we kind of look at how things were progressing in England, the oppression of the people became so prominent by the 13th century that the 25 land barons decided to raise sword, and you know, when they were happened to be together in the presence of the king, just themselves, they raised sword and held the king captive and basically petitioning him that they were no longer going to be putting up with his tyranny and these antics, that he needed to recognize these inalienable rights. And so the Magna Carta was then kind of created, recognizing the rights of the people. It was the first time ever that the rights of the people was recognized. Now, that paradigm has progressed and progressed, and it persists today. But the rights of the people are left with the people in our governing system, because the power delegated to our government is limited and defined. They can't touch our rights, which is one of the reasons why we had the 10th Amendment and the 9th Amendment and so forth, that they could only do these things delegated. And then the states, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, so we'll get back to that. So as this idea of common law and these now new rights that were established, well, it was nice, but they didn't necessarily have a good understanding. And so what I mean by that is they didn't have the scriptures, because, again, a theocracy is based on the Bible, or back in those days, these were biblical theocracies, but the people didn't have a Bible. So what ended up happening, and this was basically by happenstance, because in the 16th century, when King George decided to get a divorce, when Martin Luther decided to break away from the Catholic Church, King George says, you know what, I'm going to stretch, you know, I'm going to exert some power here. And I'm going to basically say, I want a divorce. The Catholic Church wouldn't let him have a divorce. Not King George, King Henry, sorry. And so I get names wrong all the time, so please forgive me, folks, if the names are wrong. So, anywho, King George decided to sever the monarchical theocracy from Rome, or from the Roman Catholic Empire, and created his own theocracy. And his theocracy was based upon this new Bible, but it took a while to get there. But what's most important for Henry was he got his divorce. Now, that's all he really cared about, and he didn't really care too much about, you know, cleaning up the mess. So it took about 70, 80 years, almost a century, to completely sever the relationship with the Roman Catholic Empire and establish a British monarchy. Now, what does that mean? So for you to have a unique monarchy, then, and a religious biblical monarchy, you needed to actually sever yourself away from the religious practices of the Roman Catholic Empire, where the people weren't given the scriptures. So what King James did was, got that right, because it's called the King James Version. King James said, well, we're going to give them a Bible, and we're going to get the printing presses, and we're going to actually get scholars together, and we're going to canonize the Bible for England. And so as they did that, they decided what the scriptures would be. Now, there were other scriptures out there. There's the Geneva Bible and whatever Martin Luther came up with in the Germanic states. But King George basically relied upon these scholars to determine what was going to be biblical scripture or not, whether it was included or not. So, and so you'll notice some differences between them. Already, differences between the Bibles. So King James then laid down, or I should say, poured the foundation of the British monarchy based on the King's Bible. And the Bible was given to the people, and the people rejoiced. And the people said, ah, we now have, you know, these the word of God in our hands, and now we can, you know, start living more righteously and, you know, have a righteous king. Well, it didn't work out that way. And so what ended up happening was by the 17th century, I think it was, let me see here, it was in 1600s, yeah, 17th century, there was a big revolution, and that revolution brought forth the glorious Bill of Rights to add on top of the Magna Carta. And so after the glorious Bill of Rights, this is where England really started fine-tuning its theocracy. And this is how they started living by this common law of England. So they finally fine-tuned the common law, because the common law of the common law of England was based on the Bible. And so what we have now is we have a government, a monarchical theocracy, and in essence, it was kind of a republic, because there were all these different states and colonies that were a part of, because by this point in time, Britain was the empire of the world. And it's kind of interesting, because when Britain went down this path of severing their relationship, because this is worth pointing out, when Britain severed their relationship with the Roman Catholic Empire, unlike Germany, Germany got the people to revolt, and actually got the people and the monarchs to stand up and say, we're severing our relationship and we're going to reform Christianity. Britain didn't do that. And as a matter of fact, because Britain didn't do that, it created this, I'll just say, this despotic shift where there were plenty of people within the kingdom that were not happy. Some people, you know, wanted to cling to Catholicism, but other people started hearing the words of the Protestant faith and so forth, and they said, hey, you know, we want that. We believe that's pure, that's more direct, you know, getting away from, you know, what these Catholic ideals and these Catholic doctrines. And so this became a real problem, because Britain, all of a sudden, in the move of creating a theocracy, its own theocracy, they already had factions within them. And these factions started growing, and the division between them grew. And so this is one of the reasons why there were so many British people that wanted to come to America to basically evade and get away from the religious oppression that was happening in England. And so some of the people actually went to other nations, and I think that's what the Puritans did. I forget. I think it was Dutch that they went to the Dutch nation, and then they ended up getting a charter with the king to basically create some little chartered land. And actually, if I remember correctly, it was a commercial charter. But because they weren't being inserted into America where they were promised, the pilgrims decided to change that. So everybody kind of knows these little histories of how things started. But what ended up happening was the Puritans created a religious colony based on their religious freedoms, and they were going to do these things. And they felt that because the compact or the charter was violated, because they didn't go to where they were supposed to be in Virginia, they actually went and created a whole new colony, because they realized that there was nobody around other than the Indians. And so they started creating these religious little colonies. And so it wasn't uncommon that as the colony started maturing and growing under the empire, they all had their own little religious doctrinal slants or deviations and variances. And so the revolution kicked off, and we decided to break away, and we realized that all 13 states were not united religiously. We know that. As a matter of fact, they were severely divided religiously. And so when we finally created this, and let me go back to Britain. Britain was a magistrate doctrine. In other words, they had a magistrate foundation. The king was the chief magistrate, and he had sheriffs as his, basically, his delegation down into the counties to allow him to basically, you know, deal with the people and have the people go to him, even though they had, at, by this point in time during the revolution, we had parliament and there was representation, but the doctrine of magistrates did exist, and the sheriff was capable of giving people relief and even protecting them. This was the foundation of this interesting monarchical theocracy. Well, as the government started forming in America, they maintained a magistrate because Continental Congress was all in one. And when we went through the Articles of Association and the Articles of Confederation, we proved that it was a single body, even though it was a body of multiple men. So, in other words, it was like a court or a large jury, but these were representatives from the state that created this magistrate. So it was representative, but it was still a single government. So the representatives were the king, was this magistrate. Therefore, as they started creating this, or going underneath the operations of the Articles of Confederation and started creating this new way forward, all of the states completely deviated because they had the latitude. This magistrate didn't have any power over them, and therefore the states were able to create their own trade treaties. And actually, they weren't able to do it, but they did it in violation of the Articles of Confederation because nobody could hold them accountable. The magistrate had no authority. They created a magistrate that was basically impotent. And so technically, the governing authority was really the governors, and the governors were the magistrates of these states. And so, and they had legislative bodies and so forth. And in a way, they were common law as well. Now, let me go back to common law in Britain. See, common law was the basis of the British crown, and the Bible was the foundation of the law. With that, it was under the Anglican Church. And so the Anglican Church actually didn't take kindly to these other deviations. And so, because when you have this marriage of government and religion, then you have this, I'll just say, contention. Because when people want to deviate from that, they don't like that. The government becomes very jealous of people that aren't loving them, people that, you know, are resisting them because they think differently. And so, you know, it's like a zero tolerance paradigm. You know, we're not going to tolerate, we're not going to allow you to deviate. We're not going to allow you to go down these different paths. So that was actually happening in England. Well, guess what? As the states actually declared their independence, it was already happening in America. It was happening in Virginia. And as a matter of fact, when you look at the, when the Declaration was done and the peace for the, you know, the initial treaty with Britain was passed, and we finally, you know, was moving forward under the Articles of Confederation, each state was a theocracy. There was not one state, or we should say there was not one faith that had a dominant number of states. In other words, and the good thing was that that didn't happen, because had they had a dominance, had, you know, the Anglican Church had control over 9 of the states, then they would have declared the Anglican Church to be the Church of America. And we would have been set up as a volatile nation that would have been tossed to and fro because of religious oppression. So I think the divine hand of providence kind of made sure that there was this distribution of faiths to create these disparate interests that allowed, or forced, I should say, actually forced the condition of these states to unite on principles other than religion. In other words, they actually created, because they knew they had to do this, they knew they had to create a government with, that actually had power to tax them, but they couldn't create it so that it could be oppressive. So they wanted to make sure they had a limited and defined, so religion was definitely not one of those things. And it was even brought up in the ratification debates that there was no aspect of religion delegated to them. Now, as we go forward under this new constitution and these 13 theocracies, each state that was joining the union, actually, they were established as theocracies. I believe Kentucky was Anglican. I think New Hampshire was, I think, non-congregational, something like that. But not New Hampshire, Vermont. So as these new states started joining the union, it wasn't that they weren't kind of theocratic. They actually did. And as a matter of fact, the state had this symbiotic relationship, but they weren't necessarily theocracies because the governors were not coronated. They thought that that was an evil practice. As a matter of fact, John Locke pointed out that we shouldn't have monarchs. And this is one of the reasons why they completely avoided it, but they still maintained this theocracy. They didn't have a monarch, but they still had a theocracy. It was a representative theocracy, but nonetheless, as they started growing, they started realizing that having a monolithic religious doctrine for one particular state was problematic. Madison wrote the Remonstrance on Religion in the 1780s, which paved the way for Virginia to give up the Anglican Church and actually allow the Baptist faith to flourish and to grow, and allowed this concept of the freedom of religion to kind of take a foothold in that state. And there were already two states in the Union at that point. I believe it was Maryland. When the Constitution was ratified, there were two states that believed and practiced open religious faiths. In other words, you could be of any other denomination as long as it was Christian, and you would be welcome to openly practice and a proselyte and so forth in Pennsylvania and Maryland. The other states, though, they actually had laws that kept the Baptist from being able to proselyte or any other faith other than the Anglican or whatever the church du jour was. So, the church of the day. So, what ended up happening is eventually the states started passing these secular, actually, let's call it non-denominational doctrines and establishing and breaking their ties to the church. In so doing, and as they formed their new constitutions that did not have, or as they broke those links in their existing government to basically give a stipend to the church, they turned a corner, which in a way they didn't realize had this poison with it. By creating a freedom of religion, they forgave, or they basically left the people without any compassionate services other than whatever the church could do. Because while the state and the churches were functioning together, the education of the people was handled by the church. They would, you know, the state would give them a little bit of stipend to say, you know, make sure people get educated, make sure we have educated people. Not everybody wanted education. Not everybody needed an education. They got educated in their families, and that was enough. And, you know, whatever the degree the family felt necessary, or if they wanted to go more, then the church would somehow help with that. But sometimes that was at the expense of the family, to have a tutor or what have you, because they didn't necessarily have schools other than higher learning schools. Most of the states had their own colleges, Princeton, New Jersey, and so forth. I believe Harvard obviously was a state school. It was a religious school. So when we look at the foundation of education and compassionate services, the churches were doing this in America for the people, with the minor assistance with the state, and the state kind of had laws to help protect the church in its monopoly. Well, when the monopolies were broken and the state actually went down this non-denominational path, they didn't go godless. They went non-denominational. So what's important, and we're going to go into a break here. So what's important is that they had a problem, because at the time, it's going to take me way too much time to cover it before the break hits us. So when we come back, we'll talk about how this migration away from the theocracy into a non-denominational standard was kind of a tragic turn, but we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so actually, let me back up a little bit, because when the framers were creating the nation, they basically, instead of uniting on a particular faith, they basically united on a principle called the laws of nature and nature's God. And so that was kind of like the non-denominational Christian law system, or those laws of nature and so forth that government needed to comply with or needed to stay within those boundaries so that they would actually respect the dignity and rights of each individual human. So anyway, when we started creating this abandonment of this tie, they didn't go down the path of stating that we're going to shift like the framers did in using and talking about the laws of nature and nature's God. In other words, they never, you know, went in and started really defining that at these different state levels. And so what we ended up getting was a complete abandonment, and it was kind of a free market system. Now, I think that the states felt, and I think that the design of our government was to truly have a free market economy and a free market of religion. But there needs to be something, because here's the problem. Every vestige of people, every community has to have a legal system that they, you know, basically can obtain justice from, that they can be protected and obtain justice. And so what do you do when your common law, because see, common law was based on the Bible. And so what do you do now when we actually, the common law was declared by every state and they wanted to make it that way. But what do you do when you create these governments with very specific jurisdictions? And I've said this before. What we really have is we have a hard separation between government law and jurisdiction and the law for the people or justice for the people. In other words, does the state have the responsibility of determining how to serve justice for somebody that is encroaching upon their land? The state doesn't have that power. It's not in their constitution. They've assumed that. When you look at the counties don't have constitutions. Now, when we start creating county constitutions, we're going to delegate to them the powers that we want them to have. This is where we need to get smart on the laws of nature and nature's God, so that we can find a great foundation for ensuring that everybody can have justice. Now, what may end up happening is you may have such dominating faiths in the counties, because GR is not the king. GR is not going to say this is what has to happen for everybody, because one, it would be foolish of me, it would be tyrannical of me, and three, it just couldn't happen. So the people have to decide what they're going to have. Now, in your county, when you look and you happen to be in a very rural county, there may be two or three, and it may be all Protestant faith, and so you'll all agree upon a Protestant Bible if that's what you want, and that's how you will obtain justice amongst yourselves in your own common law court. See, a common law court isn't this big, huge vestige of money that has been created by the states and the federal government. And as a matter of fact, the money will really dry up at the federal and state level when we actually start holding them accountable to the jurisdictions that they have been granted. In other words, at the federal level, if it doesn't arise under this Constitution, the Supreme Court can't even put their hands on it. What ended up happening, as we migrated away from this homogenized, you know, government with theocracies and went into these disparate sovereign states that went down their own, literally their own paths. Now, every state is sovereign. There is no standard. And the beautiful thing about the federal Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is it does guarantee the person's right to common law. And so, and every state absolutely declared the law of their state, the law of the land, is common law, except for Louisiana. Now, there's a lot of people that I've had the privilege of working with that really look at this as, no, we have the law, our law system is biblical, and they're wrong. Our law system can't be biblically based unless you've established that at your county level, because the county and the justice for the people at the county, because they want the government at the state level. It'll never happen. And I say that because when you go down to having a constitutional convention for your state, do you believe that there'll be such a dominance that they'll all agree upon one Bible? And there'll be plenty there that'll actually say, hey, hold on here, I don't like that Bible, I like this Bible. This is one of the reasons why Madison said, you've got to avoid that. Because when you entrench religion within your government, you are going to create bloody wars, because people die over their salvation. I mean, they live their lives over salvation. There's nothing more important to a person. We read Madison's, you know, essay on property. The most special, the most precious part of our property is our relationship with Christ. And government should not be involved in that relationship. It should only be involved in those things. So, unfortunately, there are people that are going to feel like they want to establish a theocracy. I deal with those people, you know, not on a regular basis, but I run into them enough. And I say, okay, good luck with that. Because reality is this. When you get to the mass of your county, I don't believe the mass of your county will believe establishing a single doctrine, you know, a single Bible, a biblical doctrine for the county in their justice system for the people in common law is going to be, you know, the best way forward. I honestly believe that it has to be probably more attuned towards the laws of nature and nature's God. In other words, there are these crimes that, you know, you can't steal, you can't do those things. And it's not about whether it's Old Testament, New Testament, or any testament. It is about a justice system that recognizes these basic laws of nature and nature's God. So understanding this, and I'm not even going to even claim to be the subject matter expert, but folks, you better start understanding, you better start learning about the laws of nature and nature's God. If we actually fix the framework, if we get our government back into the framework of its constitutions and create a constitution for your county, you're going to have to decide, do you want your county legislators to be involved in regulating your religion? And I would say no. I would say that we don't want anybody regulating your religion, because that means that they can regulate how you worship and that relationship you have with your Creator. This would be the greatest harm invoked upon we the people. And the framers saw this. They understood this. Or I should say, the Lord knew that these problems existed. He has seen we the people throughout the dispensations of time gather up arms because of what we've concocted in our heads to believe of God, and in His name killed and slayed people. Now, I know that there are enemies to God, and I know that when we actually start driving this line, walking this line of faith and so forth, it is, what's the best way of saying this? This is actually sacrilege. This is actually a blasphemy when we want to say that we are going to be the enforcers of God and God's law and His works. We have to leave those things. As a matter of fact, I've heard in, you know, good quips, you know, a Marine Corps quip is that, you know, we believe in doing, you know, going to these lands and basically dealing with, you know, these different sides of the argument. And I don't know off the top of my head the verbatim how to say this, but Marines go in and they kill, you know, everybody that is, you know, firing back, the enemies and so forth. And we believe that God will sort it out when we're done. And so we got to leave those things to God. But we do have a responsibility of protecting and serving this Constitution. And we do know that because of the 14th Amendment, because of the Bill of Rights, because of the Constitution and its paradigm, no state or county can make and enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities. So this concept, the concept of having a state-sponsored church at the county level is antithetical to the Constitution. That doesn't mean that the county cannot openly, and so let me get back to the history. As the states actually started going away from these theocracies, this was a fatal turn. And I say that because they abandoned the compassionate services for the people, left people on their own. Now, it was okay because the people were godly and they kind of helped each other out. But over time, as more and more people became WIFMs, what's in it for me, self-serving, and, you know, out to basically bleed their brothers and sisters, they didn't care. Whatever was helpful for them, that's all they cared about, as we became more selfish as a society. Now, not everybody's that way, but there's become a prominent trend that more and more people, they're all becoming WIFMs, and they don't care about anybody else. Now, let's all think that we all have, you know, at least some moniker of humanity and some, you know, compassion for our fellow man, and that we are capable of making a turn and saying we do have this responsibility. In an enlightened society, we should actually shudder. We should actually, you know, take shame in having a society that abandons the most vulnerable, the children, the widows, the infirm, those people. I mean, that is not an enlightened society. Hitler tried to create that type of enlightened society by basically killing the infirmed and the elderly, because those were the first people that went to the gas chamber. And as soon as he got people to actually justify getting rid of those who were dragging down society because they weren't productive, then it made it easier to make the next leap of going after the next victim, which were the Jews. Now, we need to be vigilant into these core principles that every person deserves some dignity. The welfare should never come from the state, but the state needs to encourage and actually reward organizations that actually elevate the standards of living for people. In other words, if you've got fentanyl and drug users and addicts that are homeless in your community, then the state or the county should basically say, we need organizations to reach out and get these people converted, get them to become contributing members to society, and get them to become self-sufficient, and reward those organizations that do that, and let people come with a plan and say, you know what? Because, folks, we all benefit when everybody becomes a contributing member, because people aren't going to be breaking into your house to feed their habit of drugs. When we actually start addressing the elephants in the room, such as addiction, like gambling, like pornography, like drugs and so forth, when we actually start addressing that and trying to edge that and get rid of those addictions, then we actually get more and more, we get more and more people becoming positive producers in society. And as more and more people become positive producers, we actually turn that corner to where we're all working and elevating. As I have said on my website, on Moby Strip Press, and when I look at the when I look at liberty and the definition of liberty, I think that there's probably no better way to, you know, to go after that than, you know, what I basically, I've got this little citation out of my first book that talks about civil society and under the premise of enlightenment. Civil society, this is it, quote, civil society is wholly dependent upon the symbiosis between the fundamental principles of liberty. In other words, this mutually benefiting attribute between these fundamental principles: free agency, responsibility, and accountability. When these principles are balanced and in harmony with the individual citizens, liberty then can act as a catalyst in elevating synergy within the community and within society. In other words, as we all start being willing to basically make the right decisions and be held accountable and be responsible for, you know, our existence in society, that we'll be responsible for our actions as we exist in society, these synergies will lead to stronger spiritual well-being, greater productivity, and improved health, and the development of wealth. I mean, we'll all become far more wealthy or better off. I mean, in ways, we have kind of been strapped to this evolving model of slavery that we all become employees and so forth under these big corporations, and it's getting worse and worse. I mean, if you look at the 50s, almost everybody had, you know, a pretty good toe. I mean, most all families had really much better lives. And through the 60s, things were going good, but this was where we were starting to make the turn. Today, we have a huge abyss, a huge gap between the poor and the middle class, and between the middle class and the rich and the wealthy. This is because the wealthy has been able to fortify their boundaries and protections, and have been able to basically reduce the middle class and actually decimate the poor because of these policies, these laws, these regulations and rules. They got government to actually start going after and attacking the family so that the family was no longer honored. I mean, when they started creating rules that you could get more welfare if you didn't have a family intact, that right there was hostile behavior. That was hostile social engineering that was attacking the foundation of America. That happened in the late 50s, early 60s, when those, and actually this concept of abortion, that actually happened in the 30s. And it was under genocide, or under the principles of basically helping black communities kill their babies and promoting promiscuity. when we have a society that is trying to remove the consequences of sin, then we have a society that is working to destroy us. And that's what we see. When we look at what our government does, it should not be removing the consequences of sin. As a matter of fact, sin is a, and those consequences are the motivators of doing good. And see, this is, and to be clear, our government doesn't even have the authority to do those things. There's nowhere where we've given them the responsibility or delegated and granted them the ability to do engineering. So the real problem is actually getting our government back into the framework. This is what we have to do. And in the process of doing this, we actually need to create the proper legal system for us because it was never done. It was abandoned. When we started going down this path of limiting our government, they should have been limited legally, but they started assuming jurisdiction over things they had no authority to do. Yes, we do have a right to a common law court, but that common law court may be your church. That common law court may be a non-denominational body of people, of way leaders between the different churches. However you get there in your county, that's for you to decide. That's what I was saying earlier. Our GR is not the king. But we actually, and I pray that there's ample people within each of these counties that have the capacity to understand these things. Because I am fully well aware that there are an abundance of people that don't have the capacity, unfortunately, or the desire to even know about these things. When we look at the voters of America, we look at 80% that blindly vote because they don't care. And the question is, do they have the capacity to care? Could we ever get them to care? I believe the answer is no. We want to actually get them to shift their blind faith for a party that is designed to allow the destruction to continue and to shift their blind faith towards those of us who want to preserve liberty and the framework of our government that we can actually get back on the path of enlightenment. We can do this, and we need to get them to realize that they just have to shift that. And I believe that they will when we actually start using petitions. But here's the point. When we look at our legal system is going to be derived at your local level. And when I see our legal system, we actually have two. And technically, when you really break it down, there are going to be four legal systems. You're going to have a county court, and the county court is going to be basically tied to the state court. And the state court is going to be, its own court, milieu, environment. And it's going to be tied to the federal court, because those things that are delegated to the federal government, the state will have that responsibility to interface those very few remote granted powers of jurisdiction. Now, the county is the same thing with those very few powers granted. So here's the problem. Well, one of the things we have to do moving forward to get back to and to ensure that we actually have better constitutions with better limitations. I need to say that slowly. We need to make sure that every constitution from the county and state are modeled like the federal government, like the federal constitution, where everything is clearly delineated that they can possess these properties, that they can possess these powers and so forth. Do we want our state government to be able to say and state claim to the property to be able to tax it and take it from you? No. Remember, we the people institute government with the primary objects of two things: to protect our lives and to protect our private property. If our government is taxing us and taking our private property because we can't pay the tax, then our government has gotten outside of those two principles or those two objects of why we created them in the first place. So we either have to shift, because in the beginning of this constitutional republic, property tax was voluntary. And it was voluntary to those who wanted to vote. You wanted to vote, you paid your property tax. So in other words, if you didn't own property, you couldn't vote. And I'm putting these things out here so that you can start seeing of how we need to start framing this. Because when we looked at the way they kind of created these big, hard, you know, I'll just say lines in the road where you couldn't cross, you had to own property to vote. I believe that everybody should be able to vote for their own representative, but I don't believe that they should be voting in all these other elections, such as, you know, levies to, you know, come up with money to pay for schools or anything outside of representation. So, in other words, we the people should literally be constrained more in how we can vote. If you own property, then you should be able to vote in certain things. But if you don't own property, then you only vote for your representation, your county, your state, and your federal representative, wanting to make sure that you actually have voice in your government. But if you want to delegate to your state the power to operate the education system, and that they're going to pay this by some means, whether that be a stipend or what have you, we need to make sure that even though they can tax your property, they cannot take your property. So therein lies the rub. If all of a sudden you can't pay your taxes, then you don't get to vote on those things. In other words, it's almost like you may be a property owner, but you no longer get to vote on how we fund things. And even though they're not taking your taxes because you're not paying them, these other people, because this becomes the voluntary system. And I believe when we start looking at the voluntary system, when people don't like what the heck's going on, they're going to opt out. And all of a sudden, these undesirable things will only happen where the people have undesirable minds, i.e. the cities may actually be promoting these bad things, and they will actually deal with them. This goes back to, you know, allowing any species, if you allow them enough rope, they will always hang themselves. Do we need to create governments that protect the people from their own government? In other words, because the people are the ones that are creating and driving their government. So I believe at the county level, we need to allow counties to fail. Excuse me. And when a county fails, then not the state, but the other counties need to go into conservatorship, or that county goes into conservatorship, and these other counties come in and say, look, you can't do these things anymore because you're actually creating a hostile environment. You're doing these things that are actually causing all of these problems. Now, this goes down to another thing that we really need to probably talk about. Now, I'm only talking theoretically, so I'm expecting a lot of people to give me hate mail. But when we start talking about these things, again, I'm GR. I'm just saying that we've got these problems, these elephants, and we need to start putting these things on the table. One of those things that we need to also start putting on the table is this concept of how, you know, we are actually going to fund these different objects that we want to have them have government do. How do we want to create the taxation for that? And so we need to get going, but we'll carry this over onto Monday. I'm GR Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.